KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is not just an attack on Mahmoud because he has a green card. This is an attack on all immigrants who call this country home.
As over 1,000 protesters rallied in New York, a federal judge temporarily blocked the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University Gaza protest leader who was taken by ICE from his Columbia housing on Saturday, even though he has a green card. He's now being held in Louisiana. As outrage grows over his detention, President Trump's warning this is, quote, the first arrest of many to come. We'll get the latest. Then to Syria, where an estimated 1,300 people have been killed in fighting in Syria's coastal region, the heartland of the country's Alawite minority, once a bastion of support for the Assad family.
We don't want a sectarian war. We want to rebuild our country. We don't want bloodshed, neither from us nor them, because it won't change anything. There are those who benefit from war and don't want Syria to recover. They profit while civilians on both sides suffer. But we reject that. We want peace. We want our country to heal.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Russia, at least 3 people were killed, more than a dozen others injured earlier today as a Ukrainian drone struck a meat warehouse in Moscow. The deadly strike was part of what Russian officials called Ukraine's largest ever drone attack on the capital region, which also damaged apartment buildings and forced the closure of Moscow's 4 international airports. Ukrainian drones also struck Russia's Kursk region, parts of which have been occupied by Ukraine since last August. Meanwhile, Russia's relentless bombardment continued overnight, with at least 1 person killed when a Russian drone struck a warehouse in Kharkiv. 17 others were wounded by Russian attacks. The violence came hours before a high-level delegation from Kyiv met with Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Saudi Arabia for talks hosted by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The talks are focused on a ceasefire. Ukraine is seeking security guarantees from the U.S., while Trump administration officials are looking to secure a rare minerals deal, giving U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth elements and other resources. They're the highest-level talks between the U.S. and Ukraine since February 28th, when President Trump and Vice President Vance publicly berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office. On Monday, Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, said Zelensky had apologized to Trump in a letter. Israel's continuing to blockade fuel and all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza after it cut off the territory's electricity Sunday. Qatar and Jordan accused Israel of imposing starvation on Gaza as Israel repeatedly violates the ceasefire agreement. This is the head of UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestinian refugees.
Whatever the intent is, it's clearly a weaponization of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Basically, we are back to a situation which prevailed at the beginning of the war, when there was a total siege imposed on Gaza. And we have seen the situation deteriorating very, very quickly.
Meanwhile, Israel's Minister of Finance, Bezalel Smotrich, has called for expelling 5,000 Palestinians a day from Gaza as part of an illegal plan proposed by President Trump to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. Israeli soldiers have killed at least 4 people in Gaza over the last day. In the occupied West Bank, Israel's killed at least 3 Palestinians in Jenin as it continues its deadly raids throughout the occupied territory. Here in New York, a federal judge Monday blocked the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, a recent Columbia graduate who was arrested over the weekend by immigration authorities for helping organize campus solidarity protests with Gaza last year. Khalil is a permanent legal resident and has a green card. His wife is a U.S. citizen who is 8 months pregnant. President Trump boasted of Khalil's arrest, posting on social media, quote, following my previously signed executive orders, ICE proudly apprehended and detained Mahmoud Khalil, a radical foreign pro-Hamas student on the campus of Columbia University. This is the first arrest of many to come, unquote. The case has sent triggered widespread outrage, with protests erupting Monday. Faculty of Columbia and Barnard were joined by rabbis and immigrant rights advocates for an emergency press conference. This is mathematics professor. We'll go to that clip later. On Monday, the news outlet Zateo reported Mahmoud Khalil emailed Columbia one day before he was detained by ICE, asking for protection after he was targeted in a doxing and smear campaign. Khalil pleaded with Columbia administration, quote, "I haven't been able to sleep, fearing that ICE or a dangerous individual might come to my home. I urge you to intervene and provide the necessary protections to prevent further harm," unquote. Protests also took place in Lower Manhattan Monday. This is Nasisa, Palestinian Youth Movement.
Columbia administrators have a responsibility to protect their students, to protect institutions of higher education that Trump and his administration are committed to systematically dismantling. And by making concessions to this right-wing agenda, they're only laying the groundwork for further repression, and it's not going to stop at Palestine. And we have very good reason to believe it won't stop at green card holders. If they're targeting undocumented immigrants, if they're targeting student visas, if they're targeting green card holders and legal residents, what's to stop them from targeting citizens next?
In related news, Trump's new education secretary, Linda McMahon, has issued a warning to 60 universities that they're being investigated for anti-Semitism on their campuses and could face penalties. On Friday, the Trump administration withdrew $400 million in federal grants and contracts to Columbia University. Syria's new government announced an agreement Monday to integrate the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, into Syria's new state institutions. The U.S.-backed SDF has controlled a semi-autonomous region in Syria's oil-rich northeast since 2015. This comes as Syria is reeling from the worst outbreak of violence since the ouster of former authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad in December, with nearly 1,000 civilians killed since last Thursday in Latakia and Tartus provinces, most of them in massacres by fighters loyal to the new government. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was arrested in Manila today for crimes against humanity on International Criminal Court warrant. The ICC has been investigating Duterte since 2018 over his extrajudicial so-called war on drugs. The UN estimates over 8,600 people were killed during Duterte's rule, with some estimates suggesting the true toll could be three times higher. Last year, Duterte admitted under oath that he oversaw a death squad of gangsters while he served as a mayor of the southern city of Davao.
I have a death squad. A death squad, seven of them. But they are the police. They were gangsters. I command one of the gangsters, kill that, because if you don't, I will kill you.
Rodrigo Duterte's daughter, Sara Duterte, is currently the vice president of the Philippines, first vice president of the Philippines to be impeached. On Wall Street, U.S. stocks dropped sharply on Monday, erasing all of their gains since President Trump's election. The slide came as China began implementing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. meat and produce, and as Canada began adding a 25% surcharge to all electricity exports sent to the U.S. Trump also triggered investor panic when he twice refused to rule out a recession during an interview that aired Sunday on Fox News.
Are you expecting a recession this year?
I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition, because what we're doing is very big.
Elon Musk has proposed slashing up to $700 billion from Social Security, Medicaid, and programs for the poor, including unemployment insurance and food stamps. Musk proposed the sweeping cuts during an interview with Fox Business Network on Monday.
Most of the federal spending is entitlements. That's like the big one to eliminate, because that's the sort of half trillion, maybe six, $700 billion a year.
Musk has repeatedly used his social media site X to promote false and baseless claims alleging widespread fraud and abuse in federal benefit programs. This comes after Tiffany Flick, a 30-year veteran of the Social Security Administration who resigned in February, submitted a declaration to a federal court in Maryland alleging efforts by Musk's DOGE operation to undermine the agency, quote, could result in benefits payments not being paid out or delays in payments, unquote. President Trump has signed an executive order targeting the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, a popular student debt relief mechanism. The order restricts participation for borrowers and employers that the White House deems in violation of its agenda, including working with immigrants and the transgender community. It's also expected to target groups that defend Palestinian rights. Aaron Reichlin Melnick, a legal expert with the American Immigration Council, said, quote, "This is shockingly unlawful and a clear First Amendment violation. The PSLF program provides the president no authority to restrict it to only those people who work for nonprofits whose work he supports. Expect lawsuits within short periods of time," unquote. In Houston, Texas, police arrested 8 climate activists Monday as they held a nonviolent protest and briefly blocked a street near the CERAWeek Energy Conference. Protesters demanded an end to oil and gas drilling and limits on petrochemical and plastics production. Inside the conference, Energy Secretary Chris Wright said climate change is, quote, "a side effect of building the modern world," unquote. Wright said oil, gas, coal and nuclear power essentially promoted a proposed $44 billion 800-mile pipeline to carry natural gas from the Arctic Circle to Alaska's southern coast, where it would be liquefied for export.
During the last administration, there were far more restrictions on Alaska producing oil, gas, and minerals than there were on Iran. We've sanctioned Alaska more than we've sanctioned Iran. So that, of course, is just nuts.
A coalition of nonprofits is suing the Environmental Protection Agency in federal court, seeking to end the Trump administration's freezing on a $20 billion clean energy finance program created under the Inflation Reduction Act and signed into law by President Biden. In related news, the Coalition for Green Capital has sued Citibank, alleging the Wall Street giants unlawfully refused to disperse the grant funds awarded by the EPA to finance tens of thousands of climate and environmental justice projects. This comes as President Trump has withdrawn the United States from a United Nations negotiated loss and damage fund aimed at partly compensating poorer countries from the irreversible effects of the climate crisis. Nearly 200 countries agreed to establish the fund at the COP28 climate summit in Dubai in 2023. As of January, the U.S. had pledged just $17.5 million out of about $740 million in pledges from wealthy nations. Mohamed Adao, climate analyst and founding director of PowerShift Africa, wrote in response, quote, "This regrettable decision risks undermining collective progress and erodes the trust necessary for effective international cooperation." Washington Post columnist and associate editor Ruth Marcus has resigned after more than 4 decades at the newspaper, alleging censorship. Marcus wrote in a resignation note that CEO and publisher Will Lewis barred publication of her column critical of billionaire owner Jeff Bezos and his announcement that opinion pieces in the Post would henceforth focus on, quote, "personal liberties and free markets," unquote. Marcus's resignation comes just weeks after Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Anne Telnais quit to protest a rejected cartoon showing billionaires, including Jeff Bezos, genuflecting to Trump. And where crews in Washington, D.C. have begun dismantling and repainting the Black Lives Matter Plaza. The word Black Lives Matter were painted on the pavement in large yellow letters on a street just north of the White House as a tribute to the nationwide uprising following George Floyd's murder in 2020. The street mural was meant to be permanent until Republicans last week introduced a bill threatening to withdraw federal funding for D.C. unless it painted over the words and renamed the area Liberty Plaza. Area residents stopped by the street mural Monday for a final look before construction crews destroyed it.
I felt it was important to come down here and just see it one last time before it went away, since, you know, the president put a mandate on her to get rid of it or he would take funding away from the district.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, a federal judge has temporarily blocked the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University Gaza protest leader, taken by ICE from his Columbia housing on Saturday. We believe he's now in Louisiana. Stay with us.
Kick out your front door. How you gonna come? American bruiser, but you'll have to answer too.
Guns of Brixton by The Clash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
A federal judge has blocked the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, the recent Columbia University graduate who was arrested over the weekend by immigration agents for helping organize campus solidarity protests with Gaza last year. Khalil is a permanent legal resident. He has a green card. His wife is a U.S. citizen who's 8 months pregnant. Khalil was arrested Saturday at his university-owned apartment. He's now being held in a federal jail for immigrants in Louisiana. President Trump boasted of Khalil's arrest, posting on social media, quote, "This is the first arrest of many to come," unquote. On Monday, faculty at Columbia University and Barnard College held an emergency press conference where they were joined by rabbis and immigrant rights advocates. This is Nadia Abu El-Haj, co-director of the Center for Palestine Studies at Columbia.
Mahmoud Khalil has been a public face of the student movement at Columbia Barnard since last spring. During the encampment, he served as the lead negotiator with the Columbia administration. A mature and gentle human being and a politically sophisticated thinker, Mahmoud tried his best to bring a peaceful end to that encampment. In the same spirit, Mahmoud tried to negotiate a resolution between students and the Barnard administration last week during a sit-in at Milstein Hall.
Yinon Cohen is a professor of Israel and Jewish studies at Columbia University.
Rescinding visas, canceling green card, and intimidating students and staff have become the tool of choice for stifling free speech and undermining the First Amendment. Columbia University includes Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Sikhs, and athletes, and none of us will be safe unless we're all safe.
Over 1,000 protesters also gathered at Federal Plaza in New York Monday to demand Mahmoud Khalil's release. These are some of the voices from the protest.
Hands off Mahmoud Khalil!
Hands off Mahmoud Khalil!
My name's Leanne Fullahan. I'm with the People's Forum. The larger context from even before this weekend, I think, is important. The DOJ has been threatening to deport students who have stood up for the Palestinian people over the past 18 months. They have been calling them pro-Hamas. They have been saying they are anti-Semitic. They have been trying to demonize the students in the face of the American public. They said to Israeli media that they intend on putting these students in jail, not for 24 hours, but for years. The Columbia administration has been cracking down on the students without even provocation from the federal government. I mean, they only lasted one day before they brought the NYPD onto campus to suppress the encampment. Columbia has absolutely been part and parcel of this crackdown on the students.
My name is Murad Awalda. I am the president and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition. It is incredibly shameful that our communities have to continue to endure under this fascist regime simply to deliver on a publicity stunt of a campaign called mass deportation. The message that they are trying to send, which is a deplorable one, is that no one is protected under free speech in this country anymore.
An experienced leader in the immigrant rights movement, Ravi from the New Sanctuary Coalition.
They want to terrorize us. They want to intimidate us. This is my home. I was born in Trinidad, but this is my home. This is Khalil's home. This is Mahmoud's home. Right? We have been here. We are making this our community. You all are part of that community. We are going to stand up. We are going to fight. We are not going to allow this agency, this administration, to instill fear. We are not fearful. We are strong. We are unafraid. And we are going to stand up and fight. Free Mahmoud.
Release Mahmoud Khalil now.
My name is Alexa Vilas. I am a council member representing District 38 in South Brooklyn. We are standing here in support of a free Palestine. We are standing demanding the freedom of Khalil. If they cannot hear us, we must be louder. We must organize. They are coming for all of us. And it is us who will protect each other.
On Monday, the news outlet Zateo reported Mahmoud Khalil had emailed Colombia's interim president, Katrina Armstrong, one day before ICE detained him to ask her to protect him after he was targeted in a doxing and smear campaign. Khalil wrote, quote, "I haven't been able to sleep fearing that ICE or a dangerous individual might come to my home. I urge you to intervene and provide the necessary protections to prevent further harm," he said. Meanwhile, DropSite News reports the ICE agent who detained Khalil was Elvin Hernandez, who was honored by Trump during his State of the Union address in 2019, was when Trump was first president. We're joined now by two guests. Murad Awalda is president of the New York Immigration Coalition, longtime Palestinian-American activist. We just saw him in that clip speaking to the crowd yesterday. And Ramzi Qasem is a professor of law at CUNY, the City University of New York, where he founded the legal clinic CLEAR. The acronym stands for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Its mandate is to support Muslims and all other communities targeted by local, state, or federal government agencies under the guise of national security and counterterrorism, unquote. On Monday, CLEAR and the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a federal habeas petition in the Southern District of New York challenging Mahmoud Khalil's detention. Ramzi Qasem, let's begin with you. If you can explain what has taken place in the last days from Mahmoud Khalil's arrest in Columbia housing after directly appealing to Columbia's president to protect him, right through to the judge yesterday enjoining his deportation and your emergency submission.
Thank you, Amy. I can start with what happened to Mahmoud and his wife. You know, on Saturday night, they were walking home. As you mentioned earlier, Mahmoud is a U.S. permanent resident. His wife is a U.S. citizen who is 8 months pregnant. This is the family. They were expecting their first child next month. They had every reason to look forward to that momentous event. And they're coming home on a Saturday night around 8 p.m., as they're about to enter their building is when they're approached by men in plain clothes who subsequently identify themselves as DHS agents. And what they say is that they're going to take Mahmoud away because his student visa has been revoked. His wife protested and said that he doesn't have a student visa. He's a permanent resident. He has a green card. She goes upstairs to their apartment, gets the green card, shows it to the agent. The agent seems confused, calls his superiors, who apparently ordered him to take Mahmoud anyway. And so from her perspective, understandably, her husband was abducted before her very eyes, disappeared to a location in downtown Manhattan. And later that evening, our colleagues and co-counsel Amy Greer and Kyle Barron filed a habeas corpus petition in federal court in Manhattan on his behalf, asking for him to be released. And what the government did within hours of that is to move him 1,000 miles away from that courthouse down to Louisiana, to complicate, interfere with his access to the court, with his access to his legal team, with his access to his wife and to his family and to his support network. So what we ended up having to do yesterday, unfortunately, is filing a motion with that same court, asking basically for the court to order the government to return Mahmoud to New York so that he can have access to his legal team, so that he can have access to the court, and so that the court can vindicate his constitutional rights. The court has already issued an order yesterday scheduling a hearing for Wednesday, and also barring the government from deporting Mahmoud until the court orders otherwise.
But Ramzi, if he is a permanent resident and he's not, hasn't been accused of any lawful violation, what basis do they have, if any, to actually try to revoke his green card?
That is the key question, Juan. Our contention is that this is all retaliatory. The reason he was arrested and detained and targeted for arrest and detention was his constitutionally protected, First Amendment protected speech and activism in support of Palestinian lives and rights in Gaza and beyond. And the fact that he played, as your segment highlighted, a key mediation role between the university administration and student protesters, which, if anything, is laudable, it's commendable, it's what you would want any student to do. So none of that is criminal. The government hasn't even contended really seriously that there's any kind of criminal activity. There's never been an arrest or a conviction that they could point to. As far as we could tell, the government is invoking, and this is a somewhat novel approach, they're invoking the foreign policy grounds, where the Secretary of State is basically saying that this person, who is a non-citizen, who is a permanent resident, by his mere presence or activities in the United States, poses a threat to U.S. foreign policy interests. Now, none of that has been detailed or specified. And frankly, we don't believe it'll fly in court, because that provision of law may exist, but it does not exist to punish constitutionally protected speech. In other words, it doesn't trump Mr. Khalil's First Amendment rights.
And when you hear, for instance, that President Trump on Truth Social said, quote, we know there are more students at Columbia and other universities across the country who've engaged in pro-terrorist, anti-Semitic, anti-American activity, and the Trump administration will not tolerate it. What does this tell you about where we're heading?
Well, look, I mean, we've all sadly become accustomed to the sort of inflammatory and frankly racist rhetoric that emanates from the Trump administration. This is no different. When it comes to Mahmoud, it's all entirely baseless. And both Mahmoud and we on his legal team and all of his supporters, including the 1,000+ people who showed up yesterday, intend to fight to bring him back to New York and to vindicate not just his right to free speech, but everyone's rights to free speech. You know, it can't be the case that saying something that the government disagrees with becomes cause for a night arrest. No one should accept that. And so, you know, we'll fight that tooth and nail. And we don't believe that this case will set the precedent that the government believes it's going to set. It's already backfired. You know, if the intent was to silence speech and to dissuade people from coming out in support of Palestinian human rights, well, we all saw what happened yesterday in Manhattan. Over 1,000 people came out, not just in solidarity with Mahmoud, but also in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and beyond. And we don't believe that people are going to be deterred, nor is the movement that is critical of the ongoing genocide in Gaza and U.S. foreign policy and its support for Israel, nor is that movement carried mainly by non-citizens. I mean, that's also a falsehood. Americans are the ones who are driving the movement. And of course, there are many non-citizen activists among them, but it's primarily Americans. And so they're not going to be able to deport their way out of this movement.
Can you explain what's going to happen in court tomorrow, Ramzi Qasem? And also, sending him to Louisiana, was that just outright punitive?
Absolutely, Amy. I mean, our view is that his detention itself was punitive and retaliatory for his First Amendment protected speech in support of Palestinian lives and rights. And then subsequently, moving him to Louisiana was retaliatory and punitive because he filed the habeas corpus petition in federal court contesting the legality and constitutionality of his detention. And so the government's response was to try to interfere with the court's jurisdiction, to try to interfere with his access to counsel and to his family and to his support network by moving him 1,000 miles away to Louisiana, where it believes it'll have access to, you know, friendlier immigration courts and whatnot. So, you know, we hope, even though we don't expect the government to do the reasonable thing and voluntarily bring him back to New York. And if they don't tell us today that they're going to do that, then we'll be in court tomorrow asking the court to order them to do that. And we will litigate the rest of the issues, including the free speech issues, from there.
And what about the Columbia University Mahmoud lives in Columbia University housing. This direct appeal to the president of Columbia, saying he was living in fear, that he couldn't sleep. How could Columbia have protected him? Did ICE enter private Columbia housing illegally?
There have been numerous reports of ICE in various Columbia housing facilities in the last couple of weeks, some substantiated, some not. That certainly raises a question about Columbia's role. Bigger picture, though, Columbia's silence, well, I should say the Columbia administration's silence has been noteworthy and shameful. For a university that has so often professed its concern for students, it is remarkably silent now that students are literally being abducted off of the streets in, you know, surrounding Columbia's campus. And I stress that this is the administration that I'm pointing a finger towards because, you know, as your segment showed, other parts of the Columbia community, whether it's the faculty or the students, have come out, and that's commendable. They've come out in support of Mahmoud and of his family, and that's great to see. But the university itself and its role in all of this has been sadly shameful to date.
I'd like to bring in Murad Awade, president of the New York Immigration Coalition, into the conversation. Murad, your response to what has been happening now with Mahmoud Khalil?
You know, this is unfortunately part and parcel to the Trump immigration agenda that we're seeing play out, from his family separation agenda to his mass deportation plans. Mahmoud Khalil also falls under the category of this Trump administration trying to do everything it can to stymie people's rights. You know, we've seen Tom Homan go out across Fox News, CNN, and other networks talking about how individuals who are immigrants don't have any rights. And this is sort of the rhetoric that they continue to hammer down on. But fortunately, for everyone who calls this country home, they have constitutional rights. And Mahmoud Khalil is entitled to those rights as well. And what we're seeing right now with the Department of Homeland Security, and thankful for the CUNY Clear, as well as Center on Constitutional Rights, for stepping in and supporting Mahmoud in this moment, is that he has a right to due process, and that in this moment he has done nothing wrong. He's not been charged nor convicted with any crimes, and it's incredibly shameful that we continue to see Columbia, you know, spiral downward. This university used to be something that was considered the cream of the crop of universities, one of the top Ivy Leagues. There's a report from The Forward yesterday indicating that it may have been some board members of the university who actually called authorities on Mahmoud, which is incredibly disingenuous for an institution that continues to parade itself as an institution that wants to champion its students and build new leaders that we need for this world. What message is this sending to not just their immigrant students, but all their students and families, that this is something that they would be participating in?
And you mentioned the possibility of a connection directly to the university about his arrest. What about, has the university issued any statement, given the fact that they've been talking so much in recent months about free speech and protection of free speech?
It does not seem that they have yet. They did send out an email to students shortly after the incident, indicating that they were, you know, aware of situations occurring, which only begs the question, if, you know, Mahmoud was living in university-owned property, and Columbia has policies on the books that says that they will not cooperate or allow ICE onto their properties without a judicial warrant, why was ICE allowed onto that property? This is only even more so begs the question, what is Columbia's role in this moment?
Let me ask you about a New York Times piece that came out right before Mahmoud was taken by ICE, saying the Trump administration is finalizing a new ban on travel to the United States for citizens of certain countries that would be broader than the versions President Trump issued in the first term. A draft recommendation circulating inside the executive branch proposes a red list of countries whose citizens Trump could bar from entering the United States, referring essentially to a new Muslim ban.
Yeah, and this is part and parcel to, again, Trump's racist and fascist agenda that he campaigned on, and now that he is in office, is trying to deliver on. We saw this happen in part one of Trump when he was in office, and he's looking to revive that policy and actually put another ban in place. We believe that it's imminent any day now. So folks who are, intending to travel outside of the country should reconsider their travels, and people who are outside of the country who have visas or are LPRs, green card holders, should be considering to travel back as soon as possible.
I want to thank you for being with us. We've been speaking with Murad Awalda, president of the New York Immigration Coalition, and with, as well, one of the attorneys for Mahmoud. He is Ramzi Kasem, professor of law at CUNY, the City University of New York, where he founded the legal clinic CLEAR. CLEAR and Center for Constitutional Rights have filed a federal habeas petition in the Southern District of New York challenging Mahmoud Khalil's detention. For more on the criminalization of dissent and repression of pro-Palestinian activism, we're joined now from Philadelphia by Palestinian human rights lawyer, Rutgers University professor Noura Erekat. She is the author of Justice for Some, Law on the Question of Palestine. Her most recent article for the Boston Review is called The Boomerang Comes Back: How the U.S.-backed War on Palestine is Expanding Authoritarianism at Home. If you can respond, Professor Erekat, to these latest developments with Mahmoud, and talk about what you mean by the boomerang effect.
Thank you, Amy. By the boomerang effect, I am invoking Amy Sasser, Martinican essayist, author, poet, who in 1950 wrote a searing polemic on the discourse on colonialism, where he pointed a finger at European and Western leaders who were condemning Hitler for the execution of genocide within Europe's shores and telling them very blatantly that they are not different from Hitler, but have little Hitlers inside of them that they have failed to condemn because their violence has been meted out against brown and black and indigenous peoples in their colonial periphery. And in that critique, he was emphasizing that the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust that happens at the hands of the Nazis, was rehearsed on other indigenous black, brown, colonized peoples, and emphasizing that there is no violence in a colonial periphery that does not boomerang back home into the domestic sphere. And my emphasis here by invoking that was to show that there is no way to defeat fascism at home without combating empire abroad. In order to defeat U.S. state violence at home, it has to be confronted on both fronts of its domestic and its foreign image. In this instance, we have seen that boomerang come home especially quickly as the United States, under the Biden administration, continued, fomented, supplied, made possible a genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza for 16 months straight. In order to do that, repressed speech at home, fomented the attack on students, expanded presidential authority, refused to apply U.S. law, denigrated international law, and basically spread a red carpet for the Trump administration to come now and expand that repression to all other vulnerable communities. And I want to emphasize that this was possible because of the thorough dehumanization of Palestinians, because of the desensitization to their suffering, because of the racialization as violent and dangerous. There was not a blink amongst the Democratic establishment that children were being slaughtered and asking for Americans not to slaughter them. Somehow, do not kill children became an exception when it came to Palestinians. There was actually supporting the repression of universities of their students because they were described as violent and dangerous rather than celebrated as anti-war protesters in the tradition of university protests in this country. I have quotes from the Biden administration, from Biden himself, where he says, let me be clear, violent protests will not be tolerated, but peaceful protest is, suggesting that the student protests were violent when 98% of them were nonviolent, and the violent ones were violent specifically because of mob violence and because of police violence, because of drones, because of law enforcement that was sent out to the universities. It was Biden who said This blatant anti-Semitism is reprehensible and dangerous. It has absolutely no place on college campuses or anywhere in our country. It was the Biden administration, it was the Democratic establishment that has created the conditions that we are now seeing taken advantage of. The Trump administration before has tried to gut women and gender studies, DEI, critical race theory, but could not do it. But in this moment has been able to do it because all of the guards have been let down as the supposed liberal establishment allowed for these repressive regimes to be mobilized against Palestinians once again, understanding us as the lowest hanging fruit to sacrifice rather than as the canary in the coal mine that has been telling you danger is here. Those Palestinians and their allies here on university campuses heroically at points struggled to save some sort of core humanitarian principles in the United States and instead were expelled, were suspended, were doxxed, were denied graduation. And now there can be no surprise that the Trump administration is mobilizing with ease as they continue to use Palestinians as their Trojan horse in order to gut the welfare state, in order to defund universities, in order to go after minority communities. And so this message is not to point fingers, but this message is to mobilize us and to stand in line that in order to defeat this fascist rollout, Palestinians have to be centered. Palestinian humanity has to be recognized. Palestine has to be central to an agenda, not because it is exceptional, but specifically because it is not exceptional and it is central to this agenda that is being rolled out, and it can stand as the gate against further repression.
And Nora, Erekat, I wanted to ask you the warnings to more than 60 universities now that they're under investigation, even though most of those universities did exactly what they were told last year in terms of repressing the pro-Palestinian protests. The issue of how many of these universities over the last decades have increasingly relied on federal funds, on donor, private donor money to keep themselves afloat. Now they are having to buckle even further under, even though they did what they were told.
Look, the universities have been suffering from a crisis and a neoliberal crisis in their funding and in their structure for a long time, as public funding for them and subsidy has been declining and they become increasingly reliant on private capital, including from weapons manufacturers who are more subsidized by the federal government than, in fact, the DOE is subsidized by them. They have become beholden to this holding pattern. But what we get in this lesson is that this kind of anticipatory obedience to do what the administration does will not make you safe, not at the university level and not at the individual level. The only way to protect yourself is to protest in this moment. Your silence will be a target, not a shield. There is no way to put your head down and to survive this moment. And again, I want to emphasize that paying attention to Palestinians will allow you to understand what is coming. They have long been the canary in the coal mine, the Trojan horse for conservative agendas. They have been the experiment, the guinea pig for state repression. Stephen Salaita was the first professor whose tenure was not denied but revoked. Resmiya Ode had her citizenship revoked, not her green card, her citizenship revoked. The Holy Land Foundation were subject to trials where they had secret evidence marshaled against them, a blatant violation of the Sixth Amendment. All of them, Palestinians. The Los Angeles 8, Amy, you've reported on this. I love your reporting on this. And people seem to forget from 1987 to 2007, a 20-year witch hunt against 7 Palestinians and 1 Kenyan for pamphleting, for passing out pamphlets for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, first prosecuted under the McCarran-Walter Act. And when that was deemed unconstitutional for its anti-communist provisions, then prosecuted under material support until it, too, was dropped. People need to understand that what happens to Palestinians is not because we are a national security threat, but because we have been so thoroughly dehumanized. You cannot recognize our suffering and think that it's somehow justified. And that is a Zionist narrative that has fomented anti-Palestinian racism. And organizations that deem themselves to be civil rights organizations like the ADL, rather than condemn the trampling, if they were civil rights organizations, rather than condemn the trampling of civil rights violations in this moment, came out and expressed appreciation for the Trump administration's arrest of Mahmoud Khalil, as have several other Zionist organizations. And so this is the moment to develop a critical analysis of Zionism and understand where you stand on it. It is certainly a responsibility of Americans to study this because it is part of our politics. At Hunter College, the search for Palestine studies professors was canceled. This is the precise moment we should be studying Palestine in order to understand ourselves and what's coming and our responsibility in the world as an imperial power. And instead, it is being shut down under these precepts because of our failure to grapple with Zionism, our failure to grapple with American empire, our failure to understand Palestine, and frankly, our failure to listen to Palestinians.
Noura Erica, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian-American human rights attorney, professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Her most recent article for the Boston Review is The Boomerang Comes Back. Coming up, we look at Syria, where over 1,300 people have been killed in recent days. Back in 30 seconds.
البحر زيك يا حبيبي حنون وسعد زيك مجنون ومهاجر ومسافر وسعد زيك حيران وسعد زيك زعلان وسعد مليان بالصبر انا بعشق البحر
Anabasha El-Bahar by Najat El-Sahira. I long for the sea. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Syria, where the new government announced an agreement Monday with the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, to integrate them into the Syria's new state institutions. The U.S.-backed SDF has controlled a semi-autonomous region in Syria's oil-rich northeast since 2015. Meanwhile, the country's still reeling from the worst outbreak of violence since the ouster of former President Bashar al-Assad in December. An estimated 1,300 people have been killed in fighting since last Thursday in Syria's coastal region, the heartland of the country's Alawite minority, the sect to which the Assad family belongs. Nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed, according to the London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, most of them in massacres by fighters loyal to the new government. The deadly clashes began Thursday after coordinated attacks by gunmen linked to the former regime killed over 200 members of the security forces. In response, according to reports by Human Rights Watch and The Guardian, Syrian government forces, along with armed groups and individuals, poured into Alawite villages throughout the region. By Friday, reports began to emerge that scores of civilians, including children and the elderly, were being targeted in reprisal attacks. Unverified videos show corpses piling up on the streets and men in military fatigues executing unarmed people. The Syrian Network of Human Rights found the vast majority of civilians were killed by armed groups previously affiliated with Turkish-backed factions fighting the Assad regime. They're among the many disparate armed groups the new Syrian government's trying to integrate into its army. Syria's interim president, Ahmed Shara, said on Monday the deadly violence is a threat to his mission to unite the country. In an interview with Reuters late Monday night, he vowed to punish those responsible for the mass killings.
Syria is, as we have confirmed, a state of law. The law will take its course on all. And we originally fought the regime and reached Damascus to defend the oppressed people. And we won't accept that any blood be shed unjustly or goes without punishment or accountability, whoever he is, even if he were among those closest to us or the most distant from us. There is no difference in this matter. Violating people's sanctity, violating their religion, violating their money, this is a red line in Syria. This is not only a constitutional law, but it is also a moral law.
Syria's interim president Shara did not respond to questions about the responsibility of his own security forces or foreign fighters and other allied Islamist groups. On Sunday, he announced the formation of an independent committee to probe the killings and bring those responsible to justice. For more, we go to Boston, where we're joined by Yasser Minif, a Syrian scholar and sociology professor at Emerson College, who specializes in grassroots movements in Syria, the author of The Syrian Revolution, co-founder of the Global Prison Abolition Alliance. Thanks so much for joining us, Professor Minif. If you can start off by talking about who died in these massacres, the mass number of people who were killed and who killed them.
Thank you for having me. It's a devastating tragedy. So my thoughts are with all who lost loved ones and relatives. The reports, according to the reports, there are more than 1,000 people who were killed, more than 770 civilian and unarmed fighters, many of whom are Alawite, and there are also Sunni. The clashes started on Thursday night. The Syrian security forces were ambushed by Assad loyalists. And the following day, the Syrian government mobilized the population in many cities, Sunni cities, and bused them to the Alawite region, the coastal region. And that provoked sectarian violence, and the security forces, who are, as you mentioned in your report, heterogeneous forces composed of the Turkish-backed militias, who are famous for their corruption and violence against the Kurdish population in the north in the several five or six past years, were also sent to those regions, and they are behind most of the killing of the civilian Alawite in that coastal region.
And Professor, could you give our audience a brief history of the Alawite community in Syria and its relationship to the rest of the society?
So the Alawite are a small Shia minority, around 10% of the population, 2.3 million people. And the Assad regime family comes from the Alawite sect. And it instrumentalized the sect to control and to govern Syria in the past 50 years. So the Syrian government used a double discourse. On the one hand, it claimed to be secular and socialist and didn't really care about religion. But also, at the same time, it presented itself as the savior of minority, as the only way to control the Sunni majority population, and scared the minority, especially the Alawite. It also prevented the Alawite, for the most part, to have any kind of economic independence, meaning that they mostly lived in and marginalized economically and politically before the rise of the Assad family. And it made sure that many of them joined the army, security forces, and also the public sector. And this dependency to the regime made it very hard for them to be opposed to the regime during the war, the Syrian revolution in the past 14 years. So there are many opponents to the Syrian regime that come from the Alawite sect, but oftentimes they are severely and harshly repressed, put in prison, killed, assassinated. And there is also a large fragment or a section of that population that is silent and neutral. And there is a minority that supported the regime very loudly. But they were not the only one. There were many Sunni and many other sect that supported the Syrian regime. And because of that, the Sunni majority have developed, as a reaction, a sectarian sentiment against that population. And it perceived what happened on Thursday as a way to take revenge of the massacre that happened in the past 14 years.
And could you talk about the significance of the deal signed this week between the new Syrian government and the Kurdish-led and U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, especially since that area of Syria is so rich in oil?
Yeah, so the Syrian regime is facing many, many challenges, political and economic. So after the fall of the regime, Israel attacked the Syrian army and destroyed more than 90% of that army. And it has been trying to govern Syria and create a platform for political participation, but at the same time was unable to get the support of many of the minority, the Kurds in the south and the Kurds in the north and the Druze in the south, and obviously the Alawite in the coastal areas. So this is a hopeful moment for many Syrians. Many Syrians were celebrating yesterday because the Kurds have been marginalized historically in Syria and have been oppressed for many, many decades under the Assad rule. But because they were not completely supporting the Syrian revolution, many in the opposition and now the new government did not necessarily feel that they were they should take part in the political process. And so this is really excellent news. I hope that they are able to build a better future with the Kurdish population and give them political and economic rights that they deserve because of their historical marginalization for many, many decades.
Finally, Professor Munir, the interim president has tried to show the international community that he's not sectarian. But these massacres have spread fear in the minority communities in Syria. Can you talk about what kind of hope there is for the country coming together after 14 years of war?
So the interim president, Ahmed Sharia, has a long history. He is a pragmatic too. He came from ISIS first and then Al-Qaeda, and then he joined the national forces that were fighting against the Syrian regime since 2017. And after the fall of the Syrian regime, is trying to present a more acceptable image because his priority is to end the sanctions against Syria and bring funding for reconstruction. There is need for at least $250 billion to reconstruct Syria. And so he is trying to be docile with the West to a certain extent, with the Gulf countries who are going to give the money, and has been trying to avoid any confrontation with Israel. It will be to be seen to if that strategy will work. Israel doesn't want his government to be successful. Has been trying to fragment Syria. Has offered some up to $1 billion to the Druze so that they develop some form of autonomy and oppose the Syrian regime, has been also communicating with the Kurdish population in the north. But at the same time, Trump and the West want to end the war in Syria and want the new government to they want to pull away the new government from Iran and its sphere of influence. So he is managing all these tensions and contradictions, and it will be quite a challenge for him to succeed. It's going to be, I think, a major challenge, economic, political, and geopolitical as well.
Yasser Munir, Syrian scholar and sociology professor at Emerson College.